Usually when we talk about like ancient rules or moral laws, there's this underlying expectation of clean, straightforward precision, you know?
Right, yeah. We want things to be totally binary.
Exactly. Like you look at a historical commandment like do not murder, and you can instantly evaluate yourself. You just mentally check a box at the end of the day, look around the room and say, well, everyone I interacted with today is still breathing, so I guess I passed the test.
Yeah, I am a fundamentally good person.
Right. But then you step into the world of the sermon message we are unpacking today, which is grounded in the biblical text of Matthew 5, verses 21 through 26. And that neat little checkbox just completely
Oh,
vanishes.
absolutely. It evaporates.
It really does. We're looking at a moral and spiritual landscape that suddenly becomes deeply personal, highly invasive, and frankly, incredibly uncomfortable. But before we get too deep into that, welcome to the conversation. To you, our beloved family members joining us today.
Yes, welcome everyone.
Our mission today is to uncover the actual foundational attitudes required for genuine, thriving relationships, both with the people around us and, you know, with the divine.
And the premise of this sermon message, it requires a massive paradigm shift.
Yeah.
I mean, we really have to ask what happens if this ancient, seemingly straightforward rule about not taking a life isn't just about extreme acts of physical violence.
Which is how we usually read it, right?
Exactly. But what if it is actually a mirror designed to reflect our daily interactions, our secret thoughts, and our hidden, completely unexpressed anger?
Okay, let's unpack this. The sermon message starts by addressing how Jesus interacted with these ancient rules. He didn't just throw out the Old Testament law.
Right, he didn't abolish it.
No, he completed and perfected it by providing a completely new perspective. To me, it feels a lot like a massive software update for a smartphone.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, like when you download a major update, the tech company isn't tossing out your old device. They keep the hardware, but they unlock a much deeper, vastly more complex operating system.
And usually it comes with a bunch of new features you didn't even know you needed.
Right. The old system was basic, but the new one runs highly sensitive background processes you didn't even know were there. So if the old system just said, don't take a life, how exactly does this new update change the way we operate?
Well, taking that software analogy further, the old code was purely physical. It basically tracked your GPS location to make sure you weren't standing at the scene of a violent crime.
Literally just tracking your physical hands.
Exactly. But this new operating system tracks your internal data. The update is a profound shift from the physical realm to the psychological and spiritual realm.
Because historically, people have severely limited the definition of murder, right?
Oh, incredibly so. We limit it to very specific, extreme physical acts. Like we think of war, manslaughter, euthanasia, or, premeditated violence.
Because if we restrict the definition to those terrifying extremes, it becomes incredibly easy for the average person to boldly claim they are innocent.
Yeah, it's an easy out.
If I didn't start a war today, I must be doing great.
Right. And it creates this false sense of righteousness. What Jesus does here is he takes the spotlight off of our outward hands and shines it directly onto the unseen attitudes of the heart.
Wow. So the standard changes entirely.
It does. The standard is no longer just avoiding physical violence. The standard is the complete absence of destructive anger and malice within your inner life.
Which instantly moves this entire conversation from being a courtroom issue to a living room issue.
Yes, that's exactly where it lands.
If the update focuses on the internal heart, this plays out in our actual daily relationships, especially at home. The sermon message points out that true success in life is found in beautiful human relationships.
Then it delivers this terrifying warning.
Oh, yeah. It says that holding on to anger or calling a brother Raka brings severe judgment. And Raka isn't a word we throw around today, obviously.
No, not at all.
But the sermon message explains it's an insult equivalent to spitting on someone. You're treating them as utterly worthless. It even says wishing someone were dead is considered murder in the eyes of God.
The cultural weight of that word, raka, is so crucial here. It is an Aramaic term of sheer derision.
It even sounds harsh.
It does. The very sound of it is guttural, like you are literally clearing your throat to spit on someone.
Oh, wow. That's a brutal image.
It is the vocalization of absolute contempt.
Yeah.
It isn't just being like frustrated that someone made a mistake. It is looking at another human being and deciding they have zero intrinsic value.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Let's play devil's advocate and ground this in reality for a second.
Okay, let's do it.
Most of us feel completely safe from committing actual physical crimes. But who hasn't been furiously angry at a family member or a coworker or someone who aggressively cut them off in traffic?
Right, we've all been there.
Isn't it a massive overstatement to equate a traffic jam tantrum or a harsh thought with literal physical murder? I mean, a thought doesn't put anyone in the hospital.
And a muttered insult doesn't end a life. What's fascinating here is to understand why it's not an overstatement, we really have to look at the psychological mechanics of how contempt alters human perception.
Okay, how so?
Well, anger usually says, you did something bad. But contempt says, you are bad.
Oh, that is a huge difference.
Huge. When you harbor contempt, you begin building a legal case in your head against that coworker or family member.
Like you're gathering evidence against them.
Exactly. You start gathering highly biased evidence, filtering out their good traits, and cataloging every minor offense until you have completely convicted them without a trial.
You essentially turn them into a caricature of a villain in your own mind.
And that caricature is a completely dehumanized version of them. Erasing someone's humanity is the absolute psychological prerequisite for doing them harm.
Wait, really? That's intense.
It is. But we never know what tragic consequences might follow a single moment of explosive anger once that mental barrier is broken. By treating someone as worthless, by spitting on their dignity with our words or our hidden thoughts, we are participating in the exact same root system that produces physical violence.
So if I convince myself you are worthless, I can justify treating you terribly.
Yes.
And the moment I can justify treating you terribly, I am walking down the exact same road as a murderer just a few miles behind them.
That is precisely why the sermon message challenges all of us, our beloved family members listening right now, to realize that absolutely no one is free from this heart murder.
Nolan.
If you have ever harbored deep resentment, or if you have ever looked at a frustrating relative with pure contempt, you are already grappling with the profound tension of this law.
So if harboring this kind of internal anger is spiritually equivalent to murder, how does that hidden reality affect our outward lives, especially our religious
It
lives?
affects it completely.
Yeah, because the sermon message highlights a very specific and honestly disruptive verse. Matthew 5, verse 24. It says, "Leave your gift there in front of the altar. First, go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift."
Which is such a radical command when you really think about it.
It is. The underlying point is that God cares far more about the state of the worshiper's heart than the actual offering being presented. Maintaining a flawless religious facade while holding on to hatred is just empty vanity.
It is performing for an audience of yourself.
But wait, think about the practical reality of what is being commanded here.
Okay.
Imagine you are in a crowded pew, the music is swelling, you are having a deeply emotional spiritual moment, and you suddenly realize you owe your brother an apology.
You remember a conflict.
Right. God is literally saying, stop the music, step over five people in your row, leave the building, and go make a phone call.
Yeah, that is intensely awkward.
Hitting pause on worship to go fix a human conflict seems incredibly disruptive to the holy moment. So, what does this all mean for how we prioritize our daily lives? Are we really supposed to interrupt our connection with God to fix a connection with a person?
The disruption is the entire point. We have this very convenient habit of compartmentalizing our
We
lives.
really do.
We construct a spiritual box where we interact with God on Sundays, and a secular box where we interact with our annoying coworkers and frustrating family members on Mondays.
We don't let those boxes mix.
But God does not compartmentalize reality. You cannot have a broken, hateful, toxic relationship with a human being who is made in the image of God and simultaneously maintain a peaceful, flawless relationship with God himself.
Because the way we treat the creation is a direct reflection of our true attitude toward the Creator.
Exactly. Making peace with your brother isn't an alternative to worship. It is the prerequisite to true worship.
Right, you can't even get to the altar until that's sorted out.
Right. And in the ancient world, bringing a gift to the altar was a massive undertaking.
Oh, it wasn't just dropping a check and a plate.
Not at all. You had to travel to the temple in Jerusalem, purchase an animal or grain, and wait in line in a loud, crowded courtyard.
That sounds exhausting.
To abandon your gift right at the altar meant walking away from an incredibly costly, time-consuming process. The extremity of the command highlights the absolute urgency of reconciliation.
Wow.
If your heart is full of venom toward your neighbor, your hands are quite simply too dirty to bring a gift to the altar.
That reframes everything. And to really drive home the danger of getting this priority wrong, the sermon message provides some historical examples that are honestly chilling to consider.
They really are.
The primary one is the story of Cain. The text points out that Cain is the ultimate example of this failure. Cain actually built an altar. He engaged in the mechanics of worship.
He did all the right religious steps.
Right, but his worship was entirely for his own self-satisfaction. Because his heart wasn't right, his unchecked anger led him to literally murder his brother Abel right after the worship service ended.
The proximity of his religious routine to his brutal violence is what we really need to pay attention to here.
It's terrifying.
Cain's offering wasn't accepted. But notice the mechanics of his reaction. He couldn't physically attack God, so his rage was displaced.
He attacked the person God favored?
Exactly. The altar itself was the trigger for his hidden internal rot to finally spill out into physical reality.
Is the real danger here that Cain's story proves bad worship combined with hidden anger creates a direct high-speed pipeline to actual violence?
Yes, absolutely.
Because then you look at the Pharisees and scribes mentioned later in the sermon message. They had flawlessly executed outward worship routine.
The perfect religious resume.
Exactly. They never missed a service. They prayed at all the right times, and they tithed down to the last mint leaf. But their hearts were completely devoid of love for the people around them. So are we using our religious habits as a mask to hide the fact that we are failing at basic human love?
That is the exact trap. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it shows how easily religious routines can create dangerous blind spots.
Oh, for sure.
The human brain loves a checklist. Checking off attended service or read my daily text gives us a powerful dopamine hit of righteousness.
It feels good to get a passing grade.
It does. And that chemical hit successfully masks the cognitive dissonance of simultaneously hating our neighbor. We think, I give to charity, I show up to my spiritual community, therefore I am undeniably a good person.
All while completely ignoring the relational decay taking place in our own homes.
We use the external ritual to validate our internal goodness.
So we end up believing that our religious resume somehow outweighs our relational toxicity. We justify our sharp tongue and our endless grudges because our spiritual performance is intact.
But without the foundational attitude of love and reconciliation, the entire structure of faith collapses under its own weight. The altar transforms from a place of genuine divine connection into a theater of pure hypocrisy.
Which naturally brings us to the ultimate goal of this entire theological update.
Right, the positive side.
Yeah, we've spent a vast majority of this time talking about the negative, avoiding the pipeline of anger, avoiding religious hypocrisy, avoiding the psychological trap of heart murder. But the sermon message doesn't leave us in the negative.
Thank goodness.
It transitions to the positive, which is active, relentless love. The sermon message reminds us that God's fundamental nature is love. Therefore, true faith isn't just about attendance or avoiding bad behavior. It is about sincerely loving the people around us.
This is the shift from a defensive spiritual posture to an offensive one. You aren't just trying to avoid breaking rules. You are actively trying to generate warmth.
And the sermon message brings in the famous narrative of the Good Samaritan to illustrate this shift. And it points out something I had never really considered deeply before.
What's that?
The priest and the Levite in that story, the highly respected religious leaders who walked right past the bleeding, wounded man on the side of the road, they didn't actively attack him.
Right, they didn't cause the injuries.
They didn't rob him or beat him. Their terrible sin was simply indifference. The mandate given to us is that we must grow to be warmer people, embracing the weak.
Let's look at the mechanics of indifference, because it is far more insidious than outright anger.
How so?
Well, anger at least requires some level of emotional engagement, however toxic it might be. Indifference requires a complete shutdown of empathy.
That's a chilling thought.
The religious leaders in the Good Samaritan story likely justified walking past the wounded man by appealing to their own religious rules.
Oh, right, because touching a dead or bleeding body would have made them ritually impure.
Exactly, preventing them from performing their temple duties. They used their religion as a shield against compassion.
Wow.
They looked at human suffering and felt absolutely nothing, prioritizing their clean religious routine over a dying man.
We usually define sin by the bad things we actively commit. You know, I lied, I cheated, I yelled at my kids.
The obvious stuff.
Right. But here, doing nothing at all, just walking past someone's pain, seeing a desperate need, and feeling a blank void of nothing, treating human suffering with pure indifference, is labeled as a massive, catastrophic spiritual failure.
It's the sin of omission.
Exactly. But let's be totally honest about human nature for a second. How do we even begin to overcome that? How do we actively love our enemies or drum up genuine warmth for people we are completely indifferent to?
It's incredibly difficult.
It feels functionally impossible to just flip an internal switch and suddenly care deeply about an abrasive stranger or a relative who has hurt us repeatedly.
It feels impossible because purely relying on our own strength, it is impossible. Human willpower is simply not a strong enough engine to sustain that kind of radical, self-sacrificial love.
We just run out of gas.
We do. Eh? You can grit your teeth and force yourself to be polite for a few hours, but you cannot manufacture genuine, authentic warmth from a freezing cold heart. That is why the sermon message emphasizes that transforming our internal landscape requires leaning entirely on grace. You had to be deeply connected to a source of love outside of yourself.
So it's not about trying harder. It's about changing the source of your energy.
Precisely. And that leads to a profound reevaluation of how we measure our own growth. The true metric of our spiritual maturity isn't how much complex theological knowledge we can accumulate.
Or how perfectly we can argue a moral point in a debate.
Exactly. The true metric is whether our words, our actions, and our internal lives are literally becoming warmer as time goes by.
Becoming warmer. I love that concept. It is essentially a temperature check on your soul.
It really is.
Yeah.
Are you a safer place for vulnerable people to land today than you were 5 years ago?
Oh, that's a great question.
Are you quicker to forgive an offense? Are you significantly less easily offended by minor slights?
That's a tough one.
Are you more moved by the suffering of the weak, even when it inconveniences your schedule? If our spiritual practices aren't actively thawing out the ice in our hearts, then we are treading the exact same path as the ancient Pharisees.
We look flawless on paper, but we are freezing cold in reality.
Exactly.
So, to bring all of these threads together for our beloved family members joining us, we started today talking about the seductive comfort of checking the box on an ancient binary rule like do not murder.
And we've discovered that Jesus issued a massive system update to that law. He didn't just want our hands clean. He targeted our hidden anger, our quiet contempt, and our dismissive, dehumanizing insults.
And we learned that God takes our horizontal human relationships so seriously that he demands we pause our vertical religious rituals to go pursue reconciliation.
Because you cannot be right with the divine while you are secretly, internally at war with your brother.
Right. And we saw the dangerous, tangible consequences of ignoring that internal rot, from Cain's tragic pipeline of bad worship turning into physical violence to the Pharisees' cold, checklist-driven hypocrisy.
It's all connected.
It is. And finally, we arrive at the realization that the opposite of this heart murder isn't just a neutral state of not being angry. The opposite of heart murder is actively fighting the urge toward indifference.
It is allowing grace to completely rewire our operating system so that we become fundamentally warmer, more deeply loving people.
Well said.
We've established that unchecked internal anger is deeply destructive and that religious indifference is a silent, tragic failure. But I want you to consider this final lingering thought.
Right. What is it?
If the ultimate test of your spiritual health isn't your attendance record, but rather the genuine warmth of your everyday words and actions. Who is the one person in your life right now who is most desperate to feel that warmth?
Oh, wow.
And what is actually stopping you from giving it to them today? That completely shatters the idea of just checking a box at the end of the day, doesn't it? The mirror of this ancient text is no longer murky. It is asking us to take a really hard, uncomfortable look at ourselves, our relationships, and our secret thoughts before we dare to bring anything else to the altar.
It's a heavy challenge, but a beautiful one.
It truly is. Thank you to all our beloved family members for spending this time with us, exploring such a challenging and powerful sermon message. We hope it leaves you not just informed, but inspired, maybe a little challenged, and ready to take real action in your relationships.
Keep pursuing that warmth.
Until next time. Take care, everyone.